the very modern model of a modern major general.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Let's go ahead and get started. So, let's see how much you remember, right? So, last week, I asked you this too. So, we had a little review last week. So, now I'm asking you again, so you get these ingrained, okay? What are the three forms, the three main forms of framing revelation that we have already discussed? Anybody remember one of them?
Preterism.
Preterism. And preterism, we said, is it's all in the past. Okay? You could draw a line like this. It's all behind us. What's another way we talked about?
Dispensation.
Okay, dispensations was a part of a larger framework. It was one way of doing this larger framework.
Historialism?
What's that?
Historialism or history?
Historicism.
Historicism.
Historicism was... And historicism is all about the timeline. Okay? Events... Things happen, but it's all about the timeline. Okay? It's taking the book of Revelation and making it a big transparency and setting it down over the top of the book of Revelation. Taking history, you know, taking the book of Revelation, making a timeline, setting it down over history and interpreting it that way. The barbarian hordes, the Mongolian hordes, the Muslim invasion of Europe, that was what historicism was all about, and was really, we saw when it came about, was written primarily because of the turmoil in the Catholic Church at the time. They had two popes, and then the papacy moved to France, and then they had three popes, and people were excommunicating each other, and people were killing each other, and there were crusades going on, lots and lots of drama. People looked and they're like, it's all over, right? It's all over, and the church is the corrupt Babylon, the pope's the Antichrist. And so historicism came about really in those times and has struggled to be taken seriously to a large extent because you're so definitive at the time. Here it is, and then another 500 years go by, and you're like, oh, we need to stretch this out. We need to move the transparency and fit it over more time now. And so we'll drop some of those things, and now they be, you know, this trumpet used to mean this, but now this trumpet means that. And so it's a difficult viewpoint. However, from this really came about the Puritan view of the post-millennialism that Jonathan Edwards developed, and that the church militant would march forward and continue to improve the world, and that the world would get to be a better and better place under the workings of Christ through his church. And we see that viewpoint has persisted and remains a significant viewpoint that we will talk more about when we deal precisely with millennial theology and doctrine. But you can see where historicism is. What was the third one we talked about?
Post-millennial.
No, that was part of this one.
Oh, historicism.
We talked about it last week, and Mom mentioned dispensations, which are a part, are under the umbrella of this larger viewpoint. Anybody remember? If preterism is the past,
futurism.
Okay? Futurism is, it's all to come. Okay? It's all yet to happen. Okay? So you got preterism, the past, futurism, the future, historicism, it's all a big timeline. We have the fourth way now that we want to look at, idealism. Okay? And some of you might be familiar with this by the name spiritualism or the allegorical viewpoint. And you can see I've put here, it's all spiritual. Now these arrows in this timeline, I saw somebody, a preterist, doing this as he was describing these ways. And when he got to idealism, this was... This was his way of expressing these, right? Preterism to the left, futurism to the right, historicism, a timeline, and idealism, all things, all the time. Okay? See if that helps you any as we discuss this today. Now, when we look at the idealistic interpretation, it makes some really definitive, particular claims that, you know, we're going to talk about. And once again, I'm not necessarily giving you the most comprehensive viewpoint. And to some extent, that's because this is not the viewpoint that I settle out on. So... but I want to try to present it to you as in a fair way, as best that I can. So the idealist looks at Revelation and says, you know, it is a vision, right? John on the island of Patmos, he says that he had a vision, okay? And we see that the book itself claims to be prophecy, okay? That Jesus Christ was given this prophecy. When you look at verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. Okay? So there's a vision given to his servants of things which must take place. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John, who bore witness. Blessed is he who reads, and those who keep and hear the words of this prophecy, to keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. Okay? Now, we use the word revelation. What's the Greek word for revelation? Anybody know?
Apocalypse.
Okay? To unveil, to reveal, to make clear, to reveal what's been hidden. Okay? And so as I've studied this framework, this idealistic approach, one of the things that those who stick to this point of view is to always really bring up this key point here, that the book of Revelation is apocalyptic literature, and that the book itself is a writing style, it is written in a style that it is to be understood in this way in particular, as apocalyptic literature. And what they'll use as a reference point for apocalyptic literature is other books in the Old Testament in particular, but even non-Christian books as well that are written in similar styles and with similar points from other cultures and beliefs. But apocalyptic literature, if you turn to the book of Zechariah, you'll see probably some of the verses that are just most frequently used by non-Christians to mock Christianity, where it just uses these very expansive terms that are, you know, characteristic of the book of Revelation too. You've got riders on white horses and red horses. You've got dragons, and you've got stars falling and the moon being darkened and the sun being darkened. Just these very grand illustrative techniques that are used in the book of Revelation. You'll find some of them back in the Old Testament as well. The book of Isaiah has some of these same descriptive terms about the stars falling and the moon and the sun being darkened when it describes passages about the fall of Babylon and the fall of Egypt. Okay, and so these are apocalyptic literature. And to the idealist, it's critical to recognize that the book of Revelation should not be read literally. Okay, that's where it really, the rubber starts meeting the road. And so, while our typical hermeneutic for understanding the Bible in modern times, for us, for our church, and for other churches like ours, is the, and Pastor, you can correct me if I'm not using the terminologies correctly, but we use the grammatical, historical approach. Okay? Where we read the text and we believe that the text means what it says unless it's impossible to understand it the way it says it. Okay? And so you can more simplify this approach as saying literal when possible, figurative when necessary. Okay, and this is the general way that fundamental Bible-believing churches handle the scriptures. Literal when possible, figurative when necessary. And the idealist preachers that I've been studying and reading, Vody Bachman and many others, hold very strongly to this position when they're reading the scriptures, except when they get to the book of Revelation. And when they get to the book of Revelation and the few other chapters in the Old Testament that they classify as apocalyptic literature, then they change that hermeneutic and say it should be understood as figurative unless not possible to be understood that way, and then has to be literal instead. And as I said, I'm generalizing some here, okay? But this is, as I've been studying this is a good, solid generalization to understand where this viewpoint and how this framework works differently than where most of us have our heritage, okay? So we get to this apocalyptic literature, and we need to change the way we read it from all the rest of the Bible to understanding it, that it is purposefully written to be figuratively understood, not to be literally understood. And so they see that the passages, when you see that they are a metaphor, when they could be understood as being metaphor, or they could be understood as being an allegory, that is the preferred way to understand them. Okay? That's in the idealistic approach to Revelation. You should take those things as metaphors. You should take them as allegories, even when they might otherwise look like they're just actual narrative. And so clearly, as we read Revelation and as we finally get into the book in the coming weeks, we're going to see times where, you know, John says, this is a vision I had, and it was imagery, it was symbolic, and here's what those symbols meant. Or an angel will come to John. What did these symbols mean? And the angel will tell them. Although sometimes the angel's telling of what the symbols mean still leaves us wondering, what do they mean? Right? And so this approach sees it all as spiritual, all as figurative, metaphors and allegories most of the time. And the plagues, the judgments, the descriptions, all of these things are to be understood as being metaphorical, allegorical, or symbolic. Primarily, the main gist of this symbolism of the book of Revelation is to give us a large scale allegory of the struggle between good and evil, the struggle between Christ and Satan, and Christ's ultimate victory, and the reality that we as the church and we as individual believers face in everyday living. Okay? And so you can, and this has been, it's like, it's a really, really deep well, to understand this, and I think Vody Bachman's series on this is about 60 sermons. So I will tell you, I have not listened to all of them, okay? But I've been listening to them, and they are interesting. But each trumpet judgment is representative of some struggle that the church has. It's representative of the struggles that we face to deal with our sin and with Christ's redemptive work for us. Okay, and these and the bowls, the trumpets, the seals, all of these are figurative and are supposed to help us under this viewpoint, understanding how we live in a world that's fallen, but in a world that Christ is victorious over. Okay, it's a map of redemptive history. It's very, very involved with symbolism of the numbers. Okay, and so we'll talk briefly about this. Revelation, we see a lot of numbers. Give me some numbers that you're familiar with in the book.
Seven.
Okay. Lots of sevens. What's seven?
Perfect.
Okay. We talk about it being God's perfect number. Why? What's its connection to world history?
Creation.
7 days of creation. Okay. Okay, what other numbers?
24.
Okay. Where do you see 24?
The 24 elders.
24 elders, exactly. Okay. Now, I'm going to bring up a number here specifically. There's also 12, right? Why 12?
Disciples.
12 disciples. Before the disciples, there were the
tribes.
12 tribes. Okay, 12 tribes of Israel. Okay, what's the relationship between 12 and 24?
It's
double, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so really 24 is significant because 12 is significant. Okay, what other number in Revelation is connected with 12? 144,000. Okay, because this is 12 times 12. Times 1,000, right? Mm-hmm. 12 times 12 times 1,000. Okay? And so, in the idealist approach, okay, the number 12 is a significant number in the Bible. It's a significant number to God. He makes it more significant by doubling it. He makes it even more significant by squaring it and multiplying it by 1,000. The idealist will tell you very, very stridently. Okay, and I was really impressed about this as I listened to it. There is no 144,000. That's just a number that means and includes all the believers because it's God's number 12 times itself times 1,000. Okay, that's the significance, is that in using this number, God is telling us this is his selected people, the chosen people, and they are an innumerable amount. Such as, he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Well, does that mean God only owns the cattle on the specific 1,000 hills? No, we don't interpret it that way, right? We recognize the 1,000 means all the hills, okay? And so to the idealist, this means all the believers. And this is a symbolic, metaphorical, or allegorical way that John tells us that. In here, that God is talking about all of his people. Okay? There's no role for, or no significant emphasis or particular emphasis in idealism for the Jewish tribes. Okay? God, and for us who are come more from the dispensational futurist point of view, this is a bit of a ground shake for us because we really accept the idea that God is going to do things with his chosen people again. Okay? And we're going to talk more about that later as we delve into the book. But just as an overview right now, idealism does not ascribe to that, doesn't hold to that. Okay? What are some other numbers?
666.
Six. Okay, let's not go to 666 yet.
Oh, okay.
Okay? What's significant about the number six? Man's number. Why is it man's number?
Because it was imperfect or incomplete?
It's imperfect, and also tied back to the 7 days of creation, man was created on the sixth day. Okay, and so in light of that, when we see the number 666, what are we seeing?
Three imperfections.
Three imperfections, right? Just as we see 777 being three perfect days, we see three sixes as being a representation of perfect imperfection. Okay? Now, not to... I'll get into a little bit more about just the journey I'm going through as I teach you all of this. But just to, for a moment, to cast a little doubt towards this, right?
Yeah.
If 12 is so significant, but 6 is also
half
of 12, why is 6 bad but 12 is good? Right? Okay. These are kind of the problems when you start playing games with numbers. Okay. This, you know, that we talked a little bit already about numerology. Okay. And premillennialists, pre-tribulationists are very guilty of numerology as well. Okay, and they play lots of games with this. And I want to just caution all of us to not get sucked into this numbers game. Okay? If you want to believe they're symbolic and representative of just idealistic approach, or you want to believe that they're literal, I think those are two things you can justify. But if you start playing the numbers game and put way too much emphasis on numbers and you see numbers and patterns everywhere. Numbers and patterns are part of our lives, okay, randomly. When we test the milk on the cows every month, and I used to help the old guy who came, Ed Supa, who'd come and do the numbers and write down the weights, and these patterns would pop up, okay? Just weird to see, like, how many of them would be this number or that number. They'd make diagonals on the paper for so many. I love seeing the patterns, okay? But it's completely random. I mean, it's just cow's milk, okay? So let's not get sucked into numerology. But I bring this forward to say this is a very significant part of understanding the idealistic view of Revelation. Numbers, okay? And one of the most significant parts, then, of this comes with Revelation chapter 20. Who remembers what happens in Revelation 20? It's 1,000 years, okay? Okay, this is Satan. It says that I saw a great angel coming down from heaven with the key of the bottomless pit, and he bound Satan, that old serpent, and he cast him into the pit for 1,000 years. And then I saw thrones set up, and we who are millennialists who believe in a literal kingdom of Christ on earth say that this is the millennial kingdom. This is the 1,000-year reign of Christ. Okay? An idealist does not believe in a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ. Okay, and like I said, I'm generalizing. There may be a few exceptions. There's, you know, it's not monolithic. Everybody who's an idealist believes exactly precisely this all the time or they're out of the club. Okay, so you can find some exceptions. But in general, primarily, the idealists believe that the millennium is nonsense. They're what's called an amillennialist. And we're going to talk more about these views to come, okay? But the 1,000 years here is once again just representative of time, okay? An amillennialist believes that we are already living in the kingdom. They believe Satan is already bound, okay? Some say that he's bound, like he's currently out of the picture. Others would say that he's bound in the sense that he can no longer trouble the nations, but he can still trouble us individually. Because when you turn to Revelation 20, and go ahead and look there. I want you to think I'm making stuff up. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. Okay, and so they hold, if you read this, it says that he should not deceive the nations till 1,000 years is over. Okay, and so Bodhi Bachman in particular, very much, okay, Satan has been bound by Christ's work on the cross. And he can no longer deceive the nations, but he can still impact individual believers. Now, when it comes to the millennium and the 1,000 years and stuff, I think there's worthy discussion for, is it literal, not literal? And we're going to have some of that discussion in the coming weeks. But I will tell you that I really, really struggle with the idea that Satan is bound presently. Okay? I just, that is part for me about this way of understanding, this framework. There's a really big struggle. Okay? Other New Testament writers, Paul or Peter, says that Satan goes about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Okay? And we are told to flee, or, you know, to put on the armor of God, that we might withstand the wiles of the devil. I think there's a lot of other New Testament pictures and imagery that communicate to me that Satan is still very much active in the world. And while you can't depend on your own senses, I would, not as a primary source anyway, right? But as a secondary or maybe as a tertiary, I look out there and it's like, it sure seems to me like Satan is still having a lot of impact on the nations. Okay, so this is a really hard one for me to accept in this framework. There's other parts of this framework that even if I don't hold to them being the right interpretation of Revelation, I can see them as being helpful. Okay, if you want to look at the seven trumpets, the seven seals, and see our struggle as Christians against evil being laid out there in an allegorical way, I can see that. I can see the helpfulness in that. Okay, so, I mean, there's parts of this view or viewpoint and framework that I have found to be very interesting. But it's really difficult when I get here and I start, and they're very dogmatic about this part here, okay? So this also, this conflict about, well, is Satan bound or not, and what does his binding mean, is also very relevant to the preterist point of view. Okay, the preterists hold that Satan was indeed bound then in AD 70 when Christ came back spiritually at the fall of Jerusalem. And then it plays into kind of the historicist's point of view that, hey, things are going to get better. Okay, the post-millennial viewpoint too. Okay, the church is militant. The church is moving successfully and changing the world and growing. One of the histories that I looked at, one of the historians I studied, it was really interesting because when John wrote Revelation, of course, they were in the midst of persecution. Great tribulation for believers at that time. And they were trying to understand, what's God doing? How soon is he coming back? When's the kingdom going to get here, right? And then after, you remember some of your history, right? What happens in world history about 100 years later? What happens with the church and the Roman Empire? Anybody?
The Roman Empire accepts the church.
The Roman Empire accepts Christianity, yeah, or a form of it anyway, yeah, right? Under Constantine. And so suddenly Christianity is militant and marching and making an impact on its society. And Christian values and Christian ways of treating people does improve society. We all agree on that. We recognize that reality. And so there's important things to be thinking about, how the readers who were reading these books, how they understood them, and how that impacted the way they were translating. So just a few other points I want to lay out. The book,
of Revelation, when understood as an allegory in this idealistic, it's a map of redemptive history. It's a map of creation, of the fall, of Satan's work, of Christ's life, of the church and its persecution and its works, and of Christ's victory over evil. It's not predictive, okay? In the idealistic viewpoint, this is not a predictive book. And this is another part where I just really start to struggle, because we read in the first three verses in chapter one, this is a prophecy, okay? But the idealist says it's not predictive. If it had any sort of predictive value at all, it's the preterist viewpoint. But they generally say the book itself is not a predictive book. It is willing to accept some of the broad points of view from preterism, from futurism, and historicism. It's kind of a magnanimous approach to the scriptures, and has the benefit of being kind of unassailable. Okay, and while I've picked at it a little bit here with, you know, the numerology, and I can pick at it here with my struggle understanding, well, is Satan bound or not? When you talk to them, when you discuss this, when you listen to the debates that people have, it's much more difficult to assail even this key point about Satan being bound or not, because the idealist does not deny the fact that there is still evil influence in the world. As I mentioned, Vody believes Satan is still influencing individual people. So it's only, they answer this question by saying, well, he's bound from plaguing the nations, not that he's not out there, okay? And so the viewpoint becomes somewhat unassailable, because there's always a way to walk around the key point and then move on to the next argument. And there's two characteristics to things being unassailable, right? There's either, well, it's true and there's no way to assail this because it's the facts, or it's unassailable because it's a very good job of getting around the facts. And so,
can I ask a question?
Please, yeah, please.
Why
do.
Wouldn't they then also just say maybe nations just means all the people? They did that over there. They, right there, you pointed out that they said, oh, 144,000
right.
just means a bunch of people.
Right.
Why wouldn't they just read nations meaning, oh, it's all the people?
And that's a very good point, and I appreciate that. And it leads me to kind of one of my final parts of, I really didn't mean to be quite this. I'm not trying to stomp on this. I want you to think for yourselves, okay? And I want you to study for yourselves, because there are good things to learn from getting a better understanding of this. But turn to Revelation chapter 20.
Chapter what?
Chapter 20. Okay. Where we left, we've been looking at already. So we're going to start at verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. All right, now, I'm not a Greek scholar at all, okay? I know very little Greek. In fact, a few weeks ago, I taught you a Greek word that turned out to be Latin, so sorry about that. Dave corrected me afterwards. One of the things here is that to the idealist who is saying this binding of Satan is a figurative binding, and this 1,000-year reign is figurative, they also precisely say that this verse, this is the first resurrection, is a figurative verse. And when you study the actual Greek that goes into this is the first resurrection, everywhere else in the scriptures where this precise language is using is talking about a real physical resurrection. It's talking about new body, new life. This is the language that's used to describe what happened to Jesus Christ on Easter Day. Okay? And so to suddenly come here and take this very precise language that we use about resurrection and then say it's not real here is making a choice about interpretation that I find really, really hard to come to terms with. Okay? So I laid that out there. Like I said, I didn't want to be hard on this viewpoint in that sense, because as I've mentioned before, I think that the other viewpoints, including futurists like myself, also have a tendency to have some of these holes, and we don't like to address them. We kind of move around them. I don't know what to do with that one. We'll come back to that later, maybe. So, but this is one that I find is a very looming hole in the idealistic approach. Idealism sees itself and revelation as applicable to all ages and all time. It commends the faithfulness and perseverance of the saints. But it also has no literal connection then. There's not a literal millennium. There's not a literal reign of Christ on earth. There's not a literal 144,000 chosen Jewish people from their tribes. There's not a literal tribulation, and there's not a literal Antichrist. Okay, so these are kind of the key takeaways that I bring to you that for, and I know most of you in here have grown up as I have with the futurist point of view. These are kind of the shocking things that come to you, okay? And it's real easy when you're shocked this way to just say, well, that's wrong. I don't want you to do that, okay? I want you to think about it and recognize what I've come to recognize as I've studied preterism, idealism, and futurism, not so much historicism, okay? But those other three, that there's, you can really delve into your Bible and make these things fit really well. You can make it work. Okay, really, really well. The preterist one in particular, which I had kind of casually believed for a long time was a remnant of history, of Catholic history. There's preterists all over the place. I mean, new young men are becoming preterists in their churches and are teaching it. And they'll lay open the book of Revelation and detail precise things that happened in the fall of Jerusalem with the precise trumpet blowing and all of these things. Now, it just, and you're like, wow, it really fits. But you can, so you can take this book of Revelation and make it fit things really easily, whether you're playing with the numbers or you're playing some other game, or whatever you want to do. And this is why this book is so misused and mishandled and abused by charlatans and cult leaders, right? You can make it say what you need it to say to try and fit things in there. And I don't want to be a cult leader. I don't want to mislead you into thinking things. We want to emphasize that the book is revealing Jesus Christ, okay? And next week, I plan to kind of detail for you why throughout all of these things I have chosen and still continue to choose to be a futurist, but and why I think that's still an important distinction and place to land. But I'll tell you that one of the things I'm also finding, and maybe Dave can back me up on this some, but as I study this, what I'm also really frustrated with is the bad scholarship that I find. Really bad scholarship. Most of you know that in 2021, I did an investigation on the 2020 election. Okay? And most of you have also seen some of the things that came out, especially during Trump's first run. When he won in 17, remember that the news articles came out about this dossier and how he had been in Russia and Moscow with prostitutes. Do you remember some of that? Some of that ring a bell? And then what you found, if you dug into it, was, well, what's the source of this? Well, the source of this is this newspaper article. Well, what's their source? It's this other newspaper article. Well, what's their source? Well, it's the first newspaper's article. And you end up with this very circular justification, circular scholarship. And what I have found as I've been studying Revelation is a lot of very frustrating circular scholarship where, and I like John MacArthur, so don't take me wrong. I really appreciate John MacArthur so much. But his early notes in Revelation, when it's this debate, well, was Revelation written in AD 65 or was it written in AD 95? Well, his note says, there's no credible sources for it being written before AD 95. Well, that's not exactly helpful to me, right? And so then I find this other guy who's like, those sources that say it's AD 95, they're no good. We're going to go with our source that says it's 65. Like, well, I want to actually have like some legitimate discussion about why the 65s are no good and the 95s are good or vice versa. And instead, they're both like, that guy, you can't trust him. And that's not helpful scholarship. And I find this very true as I've studied these various things in Revelation, is that pastors, researchers, scholars take the very lazy way of referencing another scholar who references a third scholar, and then they reference back to the first scholar again. And you just get this circle. I'm like, stop that. Like, reference the Bible for me. I mean, can we get back to where you started with this viewpoint, please? And it's really been difficult. I'm not a scholar. I'm just a casual guy who's trying to understand these things, but wants to do a little bit more than, trust me, bro. You know? So anyway, I will continue to try to be very upfront and frank with you when I, you know, and not just give you that kind of casual, circular assurance that you're right, because I found somebody else who said you were right. Because he believes somebody else who told him he was right. Okay, I'm trying not to do that. Any questions, any thoughts about this, about idealism, this approach?
Well, please. With the 144,000, how a lot of people say, well, that's just an allegorical number.
Mm-hmm.
God tries to, I think that he like, he'll go 12,000 from this tribe, the tribe of Issachar, the tribe, he'll name all the 12
yeah.
tribes. So
it seems far too precise to be just blown over as like an allegory, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I agree. The apocalyptic literature issue, and I want you to consider this. If you go back into your Old Testament, you are going to find a number of passages that talk about sky being darkened, stars falling, things like that. That same kind of language. Jesus used that in Matthew 24 with the Olivet Discourse. Okay? And that's part of why we say, those of us who are futurists, the Olivet Discourse cannot be entirely fulfilled with the fall of Jerusalem because a number of the events it depicts didn't happen. Not just the stars falling and the moon being darkened, but the return of Christ and the resurrection of the dead, etc. That has not yet happened, obviously. And so how then do we deal with this apocalyptic literature kind of answer to this question? Well, the futurist looks at those apocalyptic parallels in the Old Testament and says those also remain yet to be fulfilled. Okay? This is kind of our escape hatch, okay, for this is in the understanding and reference that a lot of biblical prophecy often was fulfilled twice. That there was multiple levels of fulfillment. Sometimes there's a partial fulfillment and then there's a later fulfillment. But to some extent that's using a hermeneutic, it's using an understanding of the scriptures to answer a question that gets thrown at the futurist. Says, well, what about this? It's like, well, we believe it's partially been fulfilled, but there's more to be fulfilled later. And the idealist answer, or the preterist answer is, no, those passages are figurative and are to be understood as figurative. And so they have, and it's not an unreasonable answer to that particular point. Would be what I'd tell you as I've looked at it. It's not an unreasonable answer. Any other questions or thoughts? Anybody? tell you, this has been the hardest one to study. Just the hardest one to study. I could get the history of historicism, I could get the history of preterism, I could get the history of futurism and dispensations, but when I try to find the history of idealism, very, very challenging to get that. So it's just been more difficult. That's why this one went last. So let's have a word of prayer together.